Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. Until recently, she was the head of the political science department at the American University of Cairo, and her most recent book is Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sheila Carapico.
Nice to be with you.
And clearly, you, of course, spent a lot of time in Cairo as head of the political science department at American University in Cairo, Sheila, and just in the last few days, in fact, five people have been killed, 644 injured just in the last day. President Mohamed Morsi is calling for dialogue, but his palace, the presidential palace, is surrounded by troops and tanks, and he's standing by his controversial decree expanding his powers. So that's a sort of mixed message, isn't it?
Yes, it assuredly is. I think, things are so fluid and clearly tempers are very high. He seems to have overplayed his hand and to imagine that as, you know, Egypt's first elected president, then he can just, you know, make what seemed to a lot of people to be some pretty arbitrary decrees about matters as fundamental as the Constitution. And so I think he is genuinely a bit taken aback. And yet, of course, so are the people who are protesting against his decree because, you know, their understanding is that this was to be a process which replaced the old dictator with a new government that would be somehow bound by rules rather than personal whim. So we have, again, a quite volatile situation at the moment.
And Sheila Carapico, do you think that Morsi's, the fact that he issued these arbitrary decrees and it's feeling his oats, if you will, in terms of power, is that motivated by the fact that he's a religious fundamentalist, that he sees things so black and white that he doesn't recognize that you can't impose the kind of religious and strictures on the secular Egyptians who actually brought about this revolution?
I think that perhaps a bit of it has to do with his fundamentalist leanings. But I also think, I was talking to an Egyptian today who was saying, you know, that they're still operating in Egypt, and Morsi in particular, with a kind of very absolute notion of the powers of the executive. And so, I mean, I think some of the problems in the constitutional proposals stem from the religious element, and some of Morsi's do as well. But a lot of them have to do with the excessive concentration of power in the hands of the executive. And I actually think that's probably his real problem at the moment. You know, his real, if I might say, obtuseness has to do with the, you know, kind of, you know, I mean, everybody in Egypt has grown up in a system where, you know, whatever the president says is what goes. And there are no, you know, serious alternative channels except possibly the judiciary. And again, this is an area where he, you know, overplayed his hand by trying to sideline the judiciary. And that, I think, really does speak to the executive authority more than it does to religious belief.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond. Recently, she was the head of the Political Science Department at the American University of Cairo, and her most recent book is Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. So given that he's often referred to now by the Egyptian opposition, again, the people who brought about this revolution against Mubarak, as the new pharaoh, I understand his other nickname is the spare tire because he was considered the second choice of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right. I mean, he's kind of an accidental president in a way. I mean, he's, you know, not, I don't think, terribly well qualified.
And What's surprising about him, though, is that he's taken to power with alacrity, has he not?
He most certainly has. Yes, that's I think an accurate statement.
So my understanding, Sheila Carapico, is that what's happening here is the kind of tragedy of the opposition is, one, the French-style election process that you had runoffs and then the top two ran. And so all of the representatives of the revolutionaries, the secular and the young, etc., lost out in the first round. So they had a terrible Hobson's choice between a relic of the Mubarak regime versus a religious fundamentalist. And that part of the problem with the opposition, the people that are in the streets now battling with the Muslim Brotherhood followers, is that they're kind of like the Occupy movement here in the United States. They are very pure. They just believe in getting rid of bad government, but not participating in the political process.
Well, you and I'm sure plenty of your listeners also know that in addition, as you say, to the kind of strange French system with the runoffs and so forth, but I mean, for all these many years when you had the ruling National Party, and then the only other party at all, of course, was the Brotherhood. And in the immediate aftermath of Mubarak's resignation, there were a large number of groups that, you know, began kind of, frankly, forming parties willy-nilly. I mean, some of those, I think, will turn into viable parties, but in the short run, what they discovered was that they had, kind of a plethora of candidates and parties representing people who had opposed the whole administration, and then they stood against a reasonably unified Brotherhood. And frankly, also, you know, what remains is still reasonably unified military and, you know, diehard Mubarak supporters. And so even if, which I'm not sure is the case, but even if, shall we say, that the protesters, the pro-democracy group, the youth, whatever you want to call them, the liberals, even if they were the majority, they're not the majority in the sense of constituting a sort of solid voting bloc. And one of the things that may be happening now is that they may be coming together in a much more concerted effort to form some kind of unified coalition.
But the problem surely is that if you don't weigh in now before this constitution is written, you're going to get stuck with the constitution that's going to shape the future. It's kind of like the argument over the Supreme Court. You know, a lot of people don't get too excited about voting for Democratic candidates, but the final argument is, well, you know, look what'll happen if you don't vote for this guy. You'll end up with more right-wingers on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and there's a real, I mean, there is, even in spite of what I just said, there is now, I think, a split among, shall we say, the opposition over those who seem to intend to boycott the constitutional referendum and those who intend to vote no. And actually, that was what happened in the first constitutional proposals that were, again, if you recall, rather oddly put together and then changed after the fact and so forth. And this looks like a replay of that. But there is a real risk that, the referendum will be held, what, next week on the 15th, and that it will pass. And
it'll pass because too many people will abdicate and vote.
Right. Whereas the Brotherhood will, you know, turn its numbers out in significant force, and the majority of those who vote, you know, will vote yes, presumably. And so, I mean, there's clearly an effort now to prevent the vote from taking place. And some of that is coming from, for example, there's this large group of diplomats who said that they're not going to facilitate overseas voting, which is a principled stand, but again might have the ironic effect of diluting the no vote, because probably a significant proportion of people living overseas would vote no. But I think, you know, now there's a lot of people just trying to stop the vote from going through, and I don't know if that's going to succeed or not.
So this really has echoes of the problem on the political left. A lot of leftists would rather be righteous than effective, and by abdicating and by turning your back on the political process, you end up with the worst possible outcome.
That could be. I mean, that could be. And, you know, right now, I think, I mean, this is a slightly different point, but, you know, it's not just the left and the right. I mean, I really think there are three major groups now vying for power in Egypt. And, you know, obviously there's Morsi and the Brotherhood, and then there's this, you know, conglomerate of shall we say, left and liberal forces. And then, again, there's considerable power still in the old Mubarak appointees in the armed forces, and to a considerable extent in the judiciary, and also in the bureaucracy. And so it's really, in a way, it's a three-way struggle rather than a left-right struggle, pure and simple.
So tell us about the role of the Christians, the Coptic Christians. My understanding is that the richest guy in Egypt, who's a crony of Mubarak's, owns one of the private TV networks, and he's the guy that put out that videotape that came out of nowhere, produced here in Southern California by some Coptic Christian fanatic, I think it's the only way to describe him.
Mm-hmm.
This horrible, cheesy movie that nobody ever saw, but it had terrible political consequences, resulting in the death of four Americans, two diplomats in Benghazi. What's going on with that constituency?
Well, the Coptic constituency is, you know, it's also a complex constituency. I mean, the church itself is really very conservative and in many ways was aligned with the Mubarak administration, the old pope who's only recently deceased. And there is a segment of the wealthiest and most powerful class in Egypt who are Copts. And there's certainly a segment of the Coptic population who are not only educated, but Western educated. So they speak French at home or they speak English at home. They have advanced degrees. And then there are other Copts who are, you know, dirt poor. I mean, there's a community of Copts who live literally in the garbage heap, which is a huge garbage heap, by the way. And so it's often difficult to generalize about the Coptic constituency because, again, and even this is a slight simplification, on the one hand, it's correct to say that, you know, there's these garbage dwellers who are incredibly underprivileged and discriminated against. But on the other hand, there's some very wealthy and powerful people. And, you know, some of them, you know, they can hate monger with the best of them. And this Egyptian-American who made that film is a good example of somebody who, you know, was deliberately sowing hatred and sectarian conflict.
So what's the situation then vis-a-vis foreign interference in Egypt? Because the Saudis poured money in the parliamentary elections, and the Salafists came out of nowhere thanks to Saudi money. And they clearly have a reactionary agenda, which they've been doing for decades around the world, with very, very detrimental effects to my mind. But on the other hand, the Brotherhood, I don't believe, are that close to the Saudis, and they, of course, have a lot of influence over Hamas and, indeed, in the people that are fighting for the Free Syrian Army. So what are the lines of foreign sponsorship there?
Well, I mean, I think you identified the main one, which is the Saudis, and again, I mean, I'm never sure if it's the Saudis in the sense of the kingdom itself, or, you know, individual princes who, or you know, wealthy individuals who, you know, spend their money on overseas politics because there is no domestic politics. But regardless of which Saudis we're talking about, they clearly have been spending money, as you indicate, for decades on, you know, the most reactionary forms of Islamic education, and that they did from the Salafis, who, as you also suggested, just turned out to be more of them than anyone ever thought in Egypt. And the role of Saudi money in Arab politics in general is one of the kind of sinister and largely hidden from view factors. I agree with you that they're probably not, a major source of support for Morsi and the Brotherhood. Although, again, if you accept my suspicion that it's not one Saudi financing agency, but rather various ones, then surely some of their money must be going also to the Brotherhood.
Well,
so it's a complicated situation.
Well, of course, and it's one that the United States government appears to have been blind to forever. If they just look at what's happened in the Middle East, the fingerprints of Saudi mendacity are all over all the problems we have today. I thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Sheila Karapinka.
Nice to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapinka, Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond. Until recently, she was the head of the Political Science Department at the American University of Cairo, and her most recent book is Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and I'll answer your questions. The conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.